In recent years, Central America has become a main source of immigration to the United States, with large numbers of young people arriving at the border, driving a strong political debate here in the U.S. Almost 100,000 unaccompanied minors have crossed the border into the southwestern U.S. since 2014. More are expected in the coming months.
Our next guest went to the source and visited El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. His goal, to look at the dangerous high crime conditions that were leading young people to make the journey across Mexico to the United States and see what American funded programs are doing to try to improve conditions there.
Alan Gomez joins us now. He's a reporter who covers immigration at USA Today. Alan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we might hear, Alan, these three countries have high crime rates, and people might think, well, we've got a lot of crime in the United States, too. Can you tell us, though, about the scale of crime in these three countries?
Yeah, it's always one of those things that's really hard to articulate to folks here in the United States, but just to give a little bit of a sense, El Salvador last year had 104 homicides per 100,000 people. Honduras was in the 70s, Guatemala was in the 50s. In the United States, that's four. So this is, we're talking just by an order of magnitude, so much more violent, so much more threatening than anything we experience here. And being able to spend a few days down there, you start to really realize that, you know, it's not like cities here in the U.S. where you have your good areas, your bad areas, you kind of know where you can go. That's just everywhere down there, because the threat of not just homicides, but kidnappings, extortions, just regular criminality is just so stunning. It's just everywhere people go down there.
And you talk to young people in Honduras and other countries, for that matter. How did they talk about crime? How did it affect their lives?
I mean, it's from start to finish, basically. I mean, I'll tell you about this one young lady I spoke to in El Salvador. She is finishing her college degree. She's taken a class funded by Microsoft and by USAID, that's the U.S. Agency for International Development, to get some computer skills. And, you know, you talk to her and she just seems like a very intelligent, put-together young lady. She hasn't bought a laptop because she just assumes that it's going to get stolen at some point. She wants to find a job after she graduates, but the job situation down there is so difficult, even for people with those kind of skills, that companies actually have wait lists for jobs that are already filled. And on top of that, she was telling me that her curfew is 9 o'clock. She's usually home by 8. And I don't know how many American kids you've ever heard even say something like that, but she said basically anytime she's out, she just always gets that sense that something's about to go down, something's about to get ugly down there, and so she just makes it home before the sun really sets. And so that just, it's a small little example, but I cannot tell you how often I came across that. Kids telling me just, like, very casually just about how many friends they've lost along the years, due to gang violence, relatives who've gotten killed. And it's just unbelievable. Just everywhere you turn, everybody has a story about having lost somebody, not just the threat or things like that, but having lost somebody to this incredible gang violence that's going out within those three countries.
You mentioned these high murder rates, the high crime rates. El Salvador, I think it was, the leading murder rate in the world. The only places with more violent deaths are places that are actually war zones, places like Syria. Why? Do we have an understanding of why crime and murder are so endemic in Central America these years?
Well, it's several things. I mean, first off, obviously, these are the places where the drugs that are coming to the United States are being trafficked through. You know, places further south in Central America, they actually get bypassed to some degree because cartels that, you know, where the drugs originate mostly in South America, they're usually flown to places like Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador to continue the trek up north. So you have this sort of this fight to control those avenues of where all those drugs are going to go through. But another thing that's really contributed to it is that these gangs, like there's a gang called MS-13 that is incredibly widespread in the United States. It has ties to El Salvador. That's where its members originated. But, you know, to hear people down there talk about it, before those gangs were, you know, regular kind of just, you know, punching, beat people up kind of gangs. And sorry if that's not the technical term for it. But they've really developed as the U.S. has deported in huge numbers members with violent gang ties here in the United States. So as they would return to their home countries and sort of integrate themselves with those gangs and then team up with these drug cartels that are pushing the drugs further north, that's combined to create this incredibly violent organizations that you have in each of these countries. So where before they were just arguing over, you know, dumb turf battles or stuff like that, now they're responsible and trying to control incredibly lucrative drug trafficking channels. And so that's all kind of piled up. You add the fact that these governments don't really have a lot of institutional strength. That's a lot of what the United States is trying to help them with. So the governments are very weak, are very corrupt, a lot of corruption within the judicial system. So there's not a lot of retribution for people. There's not a lot of justice for people who are committing a lot of this violence. So you just kind of put that all together, and it sort of creates this lawless scenario in so many parts of this country, of these countries.
Talking to Alan Gomez from the USA Today about his recent trip to Central America, reporting on the sources of youth immigration, would-be refugees to the United States. And Alan, talking to young people there, they're weighing a big question. I guess the risk of trying to cross Mexico, trying to cross the border in the United States, the hope of not being sent right back versus the risk of staying put and all the crime that you're talking about. How do they talk about that decision?
Yeah, and that's one of the things. I mean, they all face that. I mean, even parents, I've talked to some parents of kids who are as young as like 5 or 6, already having that talk with their kids about, you know, that decision that they're going to have to make at some point. So on the one hand, you know, I spoke to many young kids who are very eager to try to stay in their countries. They like their countries. They want to stay there. They want to make it work. But when you combine their horrible economies combined with the raging violence they see all around them, obviously tens of thousands of them have decided to make that journey. But at the same time, they all hear the stories about what happens on the way. They have to cross at least through all of Mexico, and that is just an incredibly horrible story. I mean, I've heard some, just talking to so many of them, telling me stories about what happened to their friends, to their relatives, to themselves through Mexico, where, let's just say, the Mexican police is not really helping these folks as they're passing through these areas. They're sort of faced with, do I go on this incredibly perilous journey? If I'm a woman, I'm probably going to get sexually assaulted along the way. If I'm a man, you know, I'm lucky to make it alive. Or do I stay here in this country where I could very, very well face the same fate? So they're stuck between a horrible rock and a hard place. That's why you're seeing so many of them in these last few years really saying, okay, it's worth the risk. Let me go ahead and take the risk to try to cross Mexico and get to the United States.
Alan, you mentioned briefly U.S. aid earlier. What is the United States doing in these three countries, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, to try to change conditions, change that balance to where it's more amenable to stay put for these young people?
Well, we've been helping down there for many, many years. But what's happening now is really interesting. So just this past December, Congress approved $750 million to go to those three countries. That's tripling the usual amount of aid that we send to those three countries. And what they're trying to do is sort of figure out a new way of directing that money. Before, it was mostly just security. So we're talking about assisting law enforcement, adding more training for their officers, helping the judicial system get better, helping judges, helping provide security for witnesses, you know, kind of on the law enforcement and justice side of things. But what I was hearing a lot down there, and I was talking to, speaking with the U.S. ambassador to Honduras and speaking to some government officials in each of these countries, what they're trying to do is switch things more into sort of the U.S. aid realm of things. And by that, I mean trying to do more programs to help these young kids get the education, sort of the gang diversion programs, and try to create more of an economic system where they can thrive in so that they can sort of create a level of economic independence where they can sort of create literally a zone to protect themselves. So many communities there, if you have enough money, I mean, are completely walled off. I mean, we have a sense of sort of gated communities here in the U.S., but I can tell you down there, it's a lot different. There's an armed guard with an assault rifle at the front. The bars are higher, the walls are higher. And so if they can just get into these kind of communities, if they can create the sort of economic independence to sort of insulate themselves from this violence to some degree, that's what they think is going to help them stay there more. So we're sort of seeing this shift from a security-focused aid program to more of a trying to empower them and try to improve their economic situation so that they can create a better situation for themselves down there.
The United States has militarily intervened in this region over the decades. Is there trust for the United States? Are people saying, oh, good, the United States is here to help in this new, different way? Or are people kind of steering clear of it?
They're taking the help. I mean, it's one thing to look back at history and sort of resent American involvement in Latin America. And I can tell you that there are plenty of countries throughout the region that still hold that. But these places are so desperate that they just have no other recourse. I mean, there are other agencies that have and other international organizations that have stepped in to help. In Guatemala, for example, the United Nations created a system about 10 years ago to help them with their judicial system. And that has yielded incredible results. Last year, it led to the arrest of the country's president, its vice president, several cabinet ministers, many business leaders. And so that sort of model is something that can help. So trust me, they take help wherever they can get it. And now with all this extra money coming from the United States, they're just hoping it can lead to that same result. I mean, yeah, people down there, obviously, they have their reservations with the United States, with our history down there, with the fact that a lot of the violence that they're seeing is a result of the drugs that Americans are using. And so, yeah, there's plenty of resentment there. But at the same time, they realize that at this point, they're pretty much powerless to stop it.
Alan, we'll leave it there. That's Alan Gomez from USA Today. His reporting is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.